In what ways does Dulcie Renfrey see herself as a refugee?
Dulcie is running away from a variety of things. She's probably wanted to run away for years. And after her father dies, she looks into the future and it's simply not survivable. She's running away from everything.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jamie Harrison about The Widow Nash, a historical novel set in the early 20th century West. The following program contains strong language and adult themes, which may be unsuitable for children. Listener discretion is advised. Can you give us her full name?
Lida Cordelia Dulcinea Renfrey.
Can you tell me something about the origin of that name and all the names in the book?
I think part of doing research in Butte, maybe in the immigration ledgers, was just looking at the wide variety of silly middle names, and having fun with the idea of an obsessive like Dulcie's father overdoing everything in his life, every journal, every child's name, just piling on the illusions and the meanings and what he wanted to come true out of people or theories or inventions or everything. Always more, more, more.
Yeah. I want to talk about Butte, Montana in a bit, but let's go into Walton's character. How would you describe him?
Walton, I think of as a kind of classic, hopefully classic, late 19th century self-made inventor, self-made man, curious man, no formal education, who was born at the time when people really thought they could solve every unknown in the universe, when they thought that they would know the mystery of everything. They could invent something that would cure every disease. They could invent things that could foretell earthquakes. Everything seems solvable. And he's an obsessive and he's a traveler and he suffers from the classic disease of the period too.
Syphilis, right?
Syphilis, yeah.
What were his other obsessions?
Earthquakes, women, keeping track of things in a number of notebooks. This is a strange guy.
And there are two other male characters at the beginning, Victor and Henning. Mm-hmm. Can you give just some context around those two?
Victor and Henning are cousins, and Victor is from the wealthy side of the family. He seems very controlled, he's very smart, he's very successful, but he has a variety of issues. He's not a well-adjusted human, and he tends toward violence. His cousin Henning, I don't know how much I should give away, is sort of a refugee from Sweden and has done some bad things, but is much more of a kind of gray area character.
Can you give us just the briefest sketch of plot to take us to Seattle 1905?
Well, Walton has come back. Walton has worked with Victor, his partner, for 5 or 6 years. They've been tremendously successful, and Walton has gone on this last trip to Africa without Dulcie, who he normally travels with, to sell off 3 mines. He's supposed to return with the proceeds for the mine, and he returns empty-handed with no apparent memory of what he's done with the money. Almost $1 million, which would have been a huge amount in today's money. He's been suffering from syphilis for 20 years. The fear is that it's just finally reached an end stage and that he might never remember. But they try to goose his memory. They try to temporarily cure him. They try to just wait it out. They try to find the money, all together in the Butler Hotel in Seattle.
Will you start by reading us a passage about Dulcie's world?
Years earlier, after Walton had introduced them, Victor would sit near her without quite touching, and this containment made her head reel. It seemed like a promise, and of course it was one. When they walked, he would touch her elbow and no more. When they sat together at parties, he was always 2 inches away, heat instead of touch. He was so handsome, so smart, so painfully shy. She daydreamed a revolution, a revelation, a man reborn, but that had been before the clarity of their first physical encounter. In 1901, Henning had only been in the country for 2 years. He was slender, young, and silent, more of a servant than a cousin. But as he circled in the background, he was already vigilant for something Dulcie hadn't quite understood. She was a veteran of Walton's world, and she knew Victor loved her, could tell that he desired her. But whatever difficulty he had, not entirely mysterious, as she watched his ramrod parents across crowded Manhattan ballrooms, so much of him was considerate and literate that she didn't pause to worry. Dulcie was fond of saving people, and the sense that Victor was somehow suffering within his phenomenally handsome skin, and the idea that she might change his life by allowing him even a small loss of control, was powerfully tempting.
And after that passage, we see their relationship in maybe its real form. And you don't shy away from writing about sexual violence. And I was wondering about your impulse to include that in the book.
Well, I kind of wanted to be real. Part of what I wanted to do in writing this, even at the remove of a century, was to make the point that people were not much different then, that the world was really entirely modern, that nobody, to remove that distance that you tend to sometimes get with historical novels.
Along those lines, I was surprised by the language of the book. There are a lot of relevant cuss words, and mm-hmm. I think in my own mind had sterilized.
Right.
That, you know, earlier times, or that everything was fairly euphemistic or Shakespearean, and it's not.
It wasn't, right. Yeah. And even Shakespeare isn't Shakespearean right. That way. It's not euphemistic. It's pretty
right.
Blatant. Yeah, I think if you read letters, if you read accounts, people swore. People talked in real and very direct terms, even polite households, when you read letters from the time, are remarkably, refreshingly, bracingly direct. And I kind of wanted to hit a balance and a voice that was from that era, but was honest.
There's a moment after Dulcie's been ravaged by Victor, and she says to Henning, "I wish I were dead." And he says, "No, you don't. You wish you were dead to some people." What did you mean when you wrote that?
Well, what I wanted to do is sort of explore whether it's cowardice to run away or if it's bravery. If you really run away from everything you know, you run away from the entire context of your life, you leave your family, you leave everything because you don't want to die, that's a form of bravery.
At another point, Dulcie thinks you need a man to really disappear. Where do you stand on that line of thinking? And is that an outdated notion?
It's an outdated notion.
Okay.
That's the, hopefully, just about the only outdated notion in the book. But yeah, at the time, to kind of evaporate into the West, to escape notice, I mean, she's lucky. She has money. She needed to pretend to be a widow. It really was the only way to have some independence and to have people not bother her, not notice her.
Let's go to the moment of disappearance in the book.
A woman gets off one train and onto another, and no one human sees both moments. Of the people who notice her at all, the men remember thick dark hair, worn up, a married woman, her shape and nervousness, and the women see the red hat, the hint of a blue dress. She was pale, not so pretty as to be worth long study, and her good taste might have been accidental. They remembered that she did not wear mourning and that she was alone and self-possessed. They assumed she was well-traveled and married, and not a crazy girl who'd fling her body out of a train window. Walton liked to introduce Dulcie as a child of my dotage, which was annoying given that the dotage was of his own making. Every trip began with a virtuous air, a promising mind to be checked, a surprising earthquake to be researched, and then the relief of having done his duty would light Walton like a firework, and he would slide off to f*** himself to death. He never truly saw it coming. While different hues of doctors treated him with mostly identical means, mercury and iodine enemas, purple potions and electric therapy, Dulcie learned to be anonymous. By the time she disappeared, she knew how to move and how to be alone.
You also write the West as a place to disappear or a place to be reborn. How do you see those two ideas working in the West at that time?
I think a lot of people did it. I mean, when you when you read about the West at the turn of the century, people were constantly showing up in towns, and nobody really knew where they'd come from or why they'd come there. A lot of people were surviving bankruptcy in the East. People were leaving marriages and disappearing forever. And I think the West has been a place for idiosyncratic people, refugees, to bolt to. It still really is.
If you were to reinvent yourself and disappear, how would you be reborn?
Besides smarter and younger, let's think. I don't know. I think everybody plays with the idea of running away. When I was about 25, I was living in New York, and I hated my job, and I had this brief moment of thinking, I'm going to move to Australia and raise tomatoes. How's that? It can vary. I really don't know. I guess I haven't thought of it in a long time because I'm happy. I've lived here for 30 years, and I love living here. So I think I'm past the bolting period.
I like it, the bolting period. What drew you to that time period and aesthetic?
Well, Butte's fascinating because it is just so urban, and it's just pure city. In about 1910, had 100,000 people, and I think I've read 40 different language newspapers. It had blacks, Chinese, Syrians, every stripe of humanity, and when you look at newsreels from the time, you don't see a single cowboy hat. It was an incredibly urban place. And I think of it as sort of the dawn of the modern world before the world blew up into war and our century proper, but with a very modern mentality.
What's your sense of Butte, Montana, 2017?
Well, Butte keeps having rebirths, and one of these years it will really kick in. It's a wonderful place. It's a I think earlier we joked I would have moved there if it had a longer growing season.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating place. Livingston's a little like that too. There's some towns in Montana and in the West, in Colorado, that are having tremendous rebirth. A lot of young people moving in, a lot of smart people, a lot of people who can be self-employed, and a lot of really idiosyncratic people. So. It's just not the industry of mining anymore.
Right, right.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Jamie Harrison about her book, The Widow Nash. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. On your website, you have a little tab for inspiration, mm-hmm. and you offer visitors access to images that it sounds like you placed around your office.
This comes back from this research in Butte. A lot of it was photo research, a lot of glass plates and portraits of people, but really always when I'm stuck writing or when I'm avoiding writing, I have looked at images, art books, whatever. I've done it for years. I did it when I was a student. And now I looked at I was trying to get into the period, and the best way to do it is just to look at pictures from the period, art from the period, wallpaper from the period. I have all sorts of strange things on my office, and sooner or later I have to clean off the office walls. And so the website is a place to put those pictures.
One of my favorite lines in the book also relates to one of my favorite topics in the book, which is food. At one point you end a section with a thought from Dulcie. She trusted very old cheeses.
Well, traveling at that time was risky, right?
Yeah.
Think of what it was like. I had a lot of fun. This collection of menus at the New York Public Library that's fascinating, and they're all over my office walls too. But some of the shipboard things are fascinating, and she has sailed back and forth to Europe, to Africa, I loved looking at those menus.
Did you try and recreate any of the meals?
I cook a lot. I used to cook for a living. I cooked in New York, so I've cooked a lot of the old style stuff. I think I have a list in there of things that Dulcie knew how to cook by the time she was 15 or something, and I did a lot of that. I was kind of an obsessive kid who grew up with parents who cooked.
Yes.
Had the old gourmet cookbooks, old 19th century things, and a grandmother who'd cooked sort of quite well, a lot of white sauces, fancy stuff.
I was going to say all the French classics.
All the French classics, yeah. So I tried all that.
And the book traverses, you know, across the states from New York to Seattle and then all around the world. How did you know, I guess, to make it that global?
Well, a lot of it, some of the idea was based on my great-great-grandfather's notebooks, and he really got around. And people, it's stunning how much people managed to travel at that time. So some of it was based on that. Some of it was might have to do with sitting in Montana in the middle of winter and wanting to live vicariously.
Yeah.
Some of it was looking at where mining was going on and where somebody like Walton could have gone as a consultant.
Where were some of the places?
Well, Spain, you know, looking at old mines there. North Africa, South America. I mean, South Africa was, of course, mm-hmm. a huge place, a huge, right after the Boer War, right after either Boer War, was a huge mining center. And Chile.
Can you tell us a bit more about those notebooks that you found?
They're much more polite than Walton's. but they were big scrapbooks, and they had mining ledgers in them. They had newspaper articles on a wide variety of things, little essays, little self-improvement tips. My great-great-grandfather started them, I think, in like 1862, and he was a Cornish orphan. Like Walton, he sailed over in about 1865 to Nicaragua, and he went south into Chile. He came up north through Mexico. He ended up, he died in Calumet, Michigan, in the copper mine areas up there. And he made quite a bit of money, but he went all over. He was in, I have a picture of my great-grandmother in Idaho on a horse. They were in Maine.
That's incredible. In the book, there are chapters referencing different notebooks written actually by various characters. Some of the titles, chapter titles include The Deep Yellow Book of Cures, The Sea Gray Book of Travel, The Peach Book of Lost Things. Are you particularly attached to one of these notebooks?
I kind of like The Deep Blue Book of Anomalies because it allowed me to put in a lot of stuff I couldn't fit elsewhere in the book. Part of the problem, I wrote this over a number of years, doing other jobs in between, writing other things, doing research, all sorts of stuff. And every time I'd go back in, I'd be interested in something new, and I would try to force it in. And I cut a lot of things out, too, that I lost interest in. So the Deep Blue Book of Anomalies was a place to dump things. But some of the naming was just to give it pacing. Uh-huh. It was sort of a... I began having fun with using that to change the speed and the mood and the characters out somehow. It really was a useful thing for me that way.
And there are other techniques that you use, including imagery, lists, mm-hmm. Telegrams, newspaper articles.
It's a scrapbook.
Yeah.
I think it sort of gets back to the idea of what you can find in a ledger and what that reveals.
Right.
About people, yeah.
I was also thinking, listening to you talk about the complexities of this book, as an over-incorporator myself, what advice do you have for knowing what to cut and what to keep?
Well, find a good editor. Uh-huh. Believe your editor most of the time, almost all of the time. They're usually right. I used to edit, and I believe in being edited. The key is that after you write something, put it away for a month, and then it's much easier to cut.
You're less attached.
Yeah, you're ready to kill your darlings. Yeah. It's key to cut.
Yeah. Is writing a form of disappearance?
Sure, absolutely. It is. And it's fun that way. You get to become somebody else. The first, I wrote four mysteries 20 years ago. And when I first started writing them, I think I was going to write from the point of view of a woman, somebody like me, an amateur, not a police officer. I set these in a town like Livingston. And I finally settled on writing as a man who was a police officer. And it was so much fun. It was so much fun. Nobody knew it was me, you know? You could kind of get away. It's interesting to change sexes that way.
Yeah.
And try to convince people and to convince yourself. And it really helps you somehow empathize and see the world from a different point of view. Or it helped me.
Do you have any rituals for getting into that nuanced headspace?
No, unfortunately. My life is a little too chaotic. It's hard to settle into a groove. And it's hard if you're working another job. When you finally get really cooking, you're just there. But it's really only doing it every day, even if it's only, if I have 15 minutes, as long as I keep on it to some degree. And mostly it's probably not working on a computer. It's just sitting down with a blank piece of paper in the backyard sometimes, or looking at a picture.
I want to talk about your dad, if that's okay.
Sure.
The Right Question has wanted to get your father, Jim Harrison, on the show. And I know he passed away last spring, 2016. In the course of writing this book, Dulcie's father dies, and I was just wondering, was there any resonance for you between those moments of grief?
No, because I wrote that before. I wrote those chapters. My father was sick for the last 5 years of his life. He was in a lot of pain, and I had written, some of the first things I wrote were Walton suffering from syphilis and being in pain. And it was a little hard when I read those passages again, when I was putting them back in.
Yeah. There's another line you write, grief. It was really just a swim in and out of love.
And I wrote that before my dad died.
Yeah.
And before my mother died, 6 months before him. But it holds up. It's true. It's hard, you know. It's really hard when your whole life has been spent thinking about people.
Yes. And then to lose them.
And to, yeah, it doesn't just stop. I mean, obviously, we all know it goes on and on and on. Yeah.
Yeah. Were there any lessons your dad gave to you about the writing life?
It's not a good way to make a living. I didn't grow up wanting to be a writer.
Yeah.
He wrote for years. I think I was 20 by the time he made more than $10,000 a year.
Wow.
So it was not something I aspired to. I thought I'd be a cook. I thought I'd be a historian. I also felt he really had a calling. He was a poet. He always wanted to do it. And I had no idea that I wanted to do this. I didn't really start writing. I tried to write a romance novel when I lived in New York and I was unemployed because a friend and I thought we'd make some quick money.
Yes.
The editor just kept laughing at the sex scenes in it, so that really didn't pan out well. And then I ended up writing the mysteries because I'd lost my job as an editor out here. I worked for a place called Clark City Press, and it closed, and I was in Livingston with a young child, and I wanted to stay instead of moving back to New York. And so I thought I'd try writing a mystery.
And it seemed to work out for you.
It worked, yeah. It worked for years. It was fun. It was fun.
So what's your identity like now as a writer? I mean, does it feel, you call
yourself? I'm getting used to it again. I didn't put anything out for 20 years. I wrote other books. I've always written. I feel a little odd now saying that I'm a writer. I'm not used to it. I'm getting used to it again. And I'd love to do it full time again.
Are you working on something else?
Yeah, I am. I'm about halfway through another book. I don't ever stop.
You don't.
No, I don't ever stop. As I love it. I really do. I enjoy it. It's hard to not write something down every day, whether you save it or not or use it or not. I'm in the habit.
What kind of notebooks do you prefer?
Right now, I'm writing on graph paper. It's a little odd. I don't know why. That's, but mostly I use white, narrow-lined pads.
I heard in an interview you gave with, I think, HarperCollins, where you talked about trying to transpose the book or make some connection between modern times and 1905, and I'm wondering if you can read us a passage about the end of times.
The New York Times claimed that no one knew what the future had in store, but this wasn't quite true. Walton, one of the authorities consulted, had been happy to say what he thought was going to happen next. More of the same. The world center was ripening and expanding, writhing in discomfort. The end was nigh, and they were all going to die. There was nothing biblical about this. The earth was godless, unsympathetic, and a grand killer. She didn't give a damn for her inhabitants' physical suffering and puny offerings. Instead of blaming God for the earth's sins, Walton blamed the earth for religion. Natural disasters weighed on fragile minds, and fragile minds shattered and subscribed to the notion of an angry God. If people weren't terrified, why, he asked Dulcie, would they be such idiots over and over again? In Seattle, toward the end, another sing-song, dynamism, dynamite, dice, die, diet, deity.
Can you say more about that passage?
I believe in science.
Uh-huh.
That's about all. I'm not a religious person. I believe in the earth. I believe in the beauty, the potential beauty of human beings. But I'm pretty irreligious and sort of angry about the world we're in today.
What do you think Dulcie would think of the world today?
I think she'd be disgusted.
Where would she run to?
Good question. She wouldn't run. She'd try to change it.
Which brings me maybe to my last question. There are epigraphs in the book, some which are fictitious, and one, at least one that I know, comes from a real human, Mark Twain.
Yeah. When I was nearly done with the book, I came up with my favorite epigraph, which was one of about 1,000 attributed to Mark Twain. Get your facts first, and then you can distort them as much as you please.
Jamie Harrison lives in Livingston, Montana. Look for more information about her and her book at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.